Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. This is a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, today, my guest is Wayne Kay, and he's remaining anonymous because he's in 12-step recovery. And as has been the case with previous recovering guests, that is the tradition of 12-step recovery groups to remain anonymous at the level of press, radio, and film. So Wayne is a businessman and a recovering person who will be talking about his recovery from sexual addiction. He has developed a lasting sobriety, which he will share his experience, strength, and hope with others who have walked a similar path, or for those who are desiring to walk that path. So now I welcome Wayne. Wayne, how are you today?
Good afternoon, David. I'm well. How are you?
I am doing well, and I'm so grateful you were able to fill in today. I'd like to just start off by asking you a little bit about your family of origin and what your formative years were like.
Well, David, I grew up in Texas, in the South, in the late 50s, early 60s, and I have two brothers, two sisters. I'm the middle man, and so it was a very fundamentalist, in some ways, Christian household. We went to church every Sunday, and we didn't go to a fundamentalist church, more of a mainstream Protestant church, but you know, it was in that time of our country when basically everyone went to church on a Sunday. So kind of an all-American family in some ways.
Well, I can relate to that. I had a similar situation, and I imagine that a lot of people growing up in the 50s and 60s were also in that same situation. Now, a lot of people that are recovering have experienced dysfunction or trauma in their past. Did you have any of that in your, during your childhood?
Well, David, I did. I really didn't think I did until I got into recovery and therapy and all those things when you start peeling back the layers of the onion. And like most people, I think that when they first get into a program, you know, you're going to walk into an AA meeting. That was my first meeting, as well as an SAA meeting. I was pretty sure I would go a couple of times, be cured, and never go again. And here I am almost 17 years later, sober, and still going and learning something and hopefully imparting some information along the way. But I think that people get into recovery and, number one, they think they are unique, and people are unique, but they think that people don't have the same problems that they have. So they're surprised when people in groups share with them that, oh, yeah, my dad did that, or my mom did that, or I was shamed, or I was made to believe that I need to be perfect. And so in my household, if you didn't come home with an A, it wasn't good enough. And then sometimes when you came up with an A, how come it wasn't an A+? So it, there was no winning the argument, and particularly we were expected. We were told that we were a very high IQ kids, and we were expected to excel. And don't ever come home with, you know, B, C's, and D's, or God forbid you should ever fail anything. So I was set up for perfectionism right from the get-go, and that is one of my character defects that I work on.
Let's talk a little bit about perfectionism and how that can be a trap for people in recovery and why you view that as a character defect.
Sure. One of when you, I think most people who think they're not good enough are set up by their parents and to some extent to think that at an early age that well, I'm not big enough, fast enough, strong enough to play football to be on the win the blue prize or whatever, and so. We were encouraged to compete in different ways or to learn. Compete may be too strong of a word, but when we – well, I take it back. Compete in our family was a good thing because, for instance, let me just take Boy Scouts, David. I know you know that's a big thing with me based on what I sent you. When my brother and I are both Eagle Scouts and my dad is an Eagle Scout. There was no question in my father's mind that we were going to be Eagle Scouts. And for him, in order to get approval, it was not, in addition to the A's on your report card, it was which merit badge did you work on or did you get this week or this month? And it was always trying to achieve something in order to get that approval. So from a perfectionism point of view, what's happened to me is I have in my adult life started to branch out and explore some more creative things like photography. And it's been very difficult for me to accept that my photographs are good enough to compete. Because at an early age, I was told I wasn't good enough. And so it's been a learning process for me to overcome that inner voice that says, at least you can submit something, you can try it, you know. And then suppose you do have a photograph submitted, and I've submitted a number, for instance, to the state fair, and I've recently submitted one to a local regional publication. And I took third place on this regional publication. And someone said to me, well, how do you feel about not winning? And I said, you know, actually, I feel pretty good that I was recognized for my achievement. And it's okay that I didn't win. But that inner voice inside of me said, you should have won. So that's kind of how it creeps into my life, David.
Well, I think that's a good point. And for me, the perfectionism trap is that whole thing, as you were saying, about not feeling that you are good enough. It plays into self-esteem issues, and I think that so many recovering people have self-esteem issues and can get down on themselves and beat themselves up. And that can feed into addictive processes. So thank you for talking about that. Now, you did talk about your early church-going experience. Can you tell us what your early concept of God was like?
Sure. I specifically remember a vacation Bible school when I was a kid in Texas, and they had, back in those days, they certainly didn't have PowerPoint and things like that. It was a felt board with little Velcro sticky things that held the figures on, and it showed, and they actually had a creation of hell on one side of the board, and the information imparted by the teacher was that if you didn't behave, you're going to hell. So my early days was of a punishing God who, and if you didn't behave, the outcome was not very good, obviously.
And how has that changed, or has that changed over the years?
Well, it has. Several times I have, as I've worked the steps, the first thing I did when I first got into sobriety back in the late 90s was I was going to use the word fire, but I rethink my higher power into a more someone who didn't look like Moses from the biblical paintings of Rembrandt or Michelangelo riding a cloud with a bolt of lightning coming out of his finger, but more of a something more lovable and huggable, if you will, and forgiving. And that has and that has worked for me to recreate my higher power a great deal.
I've had to do the same thing for whatever reason, and it could have been that hell business, thinking that there would be punishment if I did something, quote-unquote, wrong, that I would go to hell. And in early recovery, I decided to create the higher power for me that I'd heard Jesus talk about and let go of the higher power that was quite often portrayed in the Old Testament. So, again, I can relate to you on that. Let's talk a little bit about your sexuality and how the addiction started out for us. When did you start to get in touch with your sexuality, and how did you initially act on it?
Well, I lost my virginity when I was 13 years and 5 months old. I was in Texas, and there was a very, there was a girl in my class who pursued me very heavily, and so she was the one who took my virginity. And then we relocated from Texas to the Northeast, and couple of years went past before I ever really had another sexual experience as far as another human being. But my father kept a, I remember back in Texas, my father kept a stash of Playboys back when they're very collectible now, and I don't have them, and I don't want them either. But they, under his bed, and my brother and I would go in and grab one, and my brother had taught me about masturbation. So masturbation, to me, was a way of... It was an okay sexuality, and I also was at one point a compulsive masturbator, but I am not anymore.
Have you been able to identify the roots of your addictions, and if so, what are they?
Well, I think they would go back to... I have a therapist who calls the sex addict a firefighter, a first responder, who when I cannot deal with a situation or I feel anxiety, the first responder comes out and soothes the brain. The first thing that happens with when you start using sex is your brain gets that injection of brain chemistry that makes you feel good and it's going to be okay. So that worked for me for a number of years, and I think that the problem is that it's not a way to live as you gain recognition of it, so that you can say, hey, my first responder showed up, I'm in a bad situation, but I don't need that first responder type today. I can use some other tools I have to get me out of the situation or to deal with the situation. So the roots were perfectionism, the shame that was caused by my early sexuality. Those I think are the two big root causes. David?
Okay, thank you, Wayne. Now, you've shared that you've had a history of alcohol abuse, too. Can you tell me when the alcohol abuse and the sexual addiction began and how the two addictions played off one another?
Sure. The alcohol abuse started in high school. Back in the day, New York State drinking age was 18, and I happened to be going to school in Connecticut, high school. We would drive 20 minutes and be in New York State, and so we would use some fake IDs and if we needed them to be 18. I think in my case, I think I was probably 16 or 17 when I started drinking to excess. And that continued through college and being traveling as I was for my career. At one point, I had a virtually unlimited expense account. And being an alcoholic and a sex addict, it was like having the Feast of David in front of you. No pun intended there, David, but you know what I mean.
I do.
So. Yeah, so it was having I had the means and to travel anywhere in the United States just about and you know, sign off, send an expense report and drink and sex to my heart's content.
Now, how did your addictions play out during your early adult years?
Well. I do remember, and I have made, you know, sometimes when you're doing the steps, you can't really apologize or find that person if it was to cause harm or injury to that person. And I do remember a couple of dates where I certainly could have been considered date rape or mm-hmm. it was... My advances were unwelcome. They may not have, in some cases, culminated in the actual sex act, but I was, as an athlete, a gymnast, I was mostly stronger than my dates, and so I would, if they weren't cooperating, I would overpower them try to. But, you know, my back when you're that age, my sex addiction, which is a progressive thing, was not to the point that it was when I finally got into treatment for it. So I did stop, but in terms of someone saying stop. But in retrospect, there are a number of women that, you know, if I could find them, I would certainly apologize today.
Well, you are apologizing right now. Hopefully that message is out to the universe, and whether or not anybody is listening, you've put it out there and you've expressed that to God and to other people. And so just for people that aren't aware of the steps, one of the steps is making a list of all the people that you've harmed. That's the eighth step. And then the ninth step is to make direct amends to them, except when to do so would injure them or others. So thank you for making your amends, Wayne, at this level. Can you tell us when your addictions became full-blown?
Well, I had a number of serial affairs with my I'm married, still married to the same person, thank God. She has stood by me through some crises that we have had in our lives caused by myself. So there were, let me back up here, David, and say that my wife and I have been together over 30 years, and she was actually the other woman at one point in time. And so she knows full well the extent of my acting out, because she was, in fact, the object of my affection at one time, and knows I left my family. And now all of the kids from that were speaking to me of that, you know, after that event. So we kind of all made up and tried to be a family of it. And it's not the easiest thing. So if you're contemplating that, I would say make sure you talk it over before you make that leap, if anyone's out there listening and trying to make that decision. But as I progressed, I did get into treatment in Los Angeles in 1997. I had stabbed around it before that in 94, 95, but the local guy I went to did not refer me to any 12-step program, and I basically, as I recall, he said, well, you should quit subscribing to the Playboy channel, which I did, and you know, that was his answer. So, you know, it was, I look back on that particular therapist, and I don't want to call this person clueless, but I think that there's a vast reservoir of knowledge that this person has not tapped into yet, you know. So as I continued on, I got promoted, we moved to Los Angeles, I was away a lot, and every time I went away on a business trip, I would basically act out with someone I usually met on the internet. And so that became a serial acting out event for me. And at some point, you know, that doesn't become enough. And even with recovery, I did have a good solid piece of recovery when I first got into it. And then we left Los Angeles and moved back to the East Coast. And so when I what happened was I lost my support system. I had to find a new therapist. I had a whole new group of people to get to know at SAA meetings. And that's always daunting when you, I don't care where you're from, if you walk into a room full of strangers, sometimes it can be a little hard to overcome that. And I don't think anyone develops an immediate 100% openness in those rooms, David. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with that. I think what happens for me is that it goes back to the shame thing, that I'm afraid other people are going to judge me, and that I just kind of shut down, if you will, and am not totally honest. And that's so important in recovery. If one is going to get better. You made a couple of points that I think are important that I'd like to go over. One of them was on the note of making amends. You talked about how you thought it was important for somebody to talk that through with another person. Now, we use sponsors in SAA and in any 12-step program. Sponsors are an important link for recovering people. Would you be willing to speak to that particular issue?
Sure. Sponsoring actually encompasses several different facets, one of which is coaching, another is mentoring. Most people confuse the two, but mentoring, for instance, was named for a guy that was in the Greek Wars. When Aeschylus went to war, he left his son with a trusted advisor to raise, because when you're at war, you went for decades. And the man that he left his son with was a man named Mentor, and who raised his son and gave him the parameters to live by. And of course, I've mentioned the word coaching, and coaching I think everyone is familiar with that particular phrase or verb, that if you're on the sidelines and the coach will sit in a play, or you'll be in a classroom and the coach will give you plays the diagram. So it's a combination of someone who has the skill sets to that you can relate to, and I think that's important, to take advice from and be accountable to. No one I know of has gone into a 12-step room over a period of years and ever cured themselves. And maybe you know someone. I don't.
I don't either.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that you mentioned, you talked about how things were not enough for you. And I wondered if you would talk about the progressive nature of the disease, because a lot of people may not be aware of that.
Sure. When I was a compulsive masturbator, I actually masturbated to the point of injury. There are people that who will take today's little purple pill, blue pill, a Viagra or a Cialis, and you know, they want to perform to unusual expectations because they think that's the norm, or they think that's going to make them better. And the pharmacology aspect is, you know, I can get into NA, because then you get into other drugs, David, and I'll stop there with that one. But the progressive nature of this, I'm sorry, were you going to say something?
No, I was just agreeing with you.
Oh, okay, sorry. So anyway, the progressive nature of this, it's really related to the dopamine receptors in your brain. And dopamine is that blood chemical, brain chemical, that makes you feel better. So that, along with adrenaline and some other things floating around up there. And as you start, having an orgasm or generating that brain chemistry, over a period of time, it takes more and more dopamine to get the same effect. Now, obviously, we know that an actor who I respected just died from a cocaine overdose, and he, unfortunately, maybe didn't realize the purity of the drug, but he kept taking more and more to get the same effect. Well, at some point, you don't get an effect because you're tapped out. So the progressive nature of this is you try something different in order to try and get that same effect.
Right. And the thing that can happen is that people will engage in riskier and riskier behaviors and cross lines that they never thought they would cross. And that was the way that the addiction played out for me in my life. Let's just take a quick commercial break, and then we'll come back, and I'd like to ask you about the consequences of your addictions.
Sure.
Prepare to be shocked. Prepare to be moved. Prepare to laugh. Prepare to cry, and prepare to be inspired. Dive into David Clark's latest book, Shades of Gay, and you will find yourself plunged into the trenches of sexual addiction. You will embark upon a kaleidoscopic tour from the abyss to higher ground. In the beginning, it was love at first sight when Daniel and Mark met, but through the years, that same love became tainted. Daniel, an alcoholic and sex addict, has found himself unable to resist the lure of other men. When Mark discovers his infidelity, he leaves Daniel, who begins a dark descent into sexual tryst after tryst. Shades of Gay reveals the myriad desires a lost man can permit his body and soul to revel in, despite the pain they bring. But can such fleeting moments of pleasure bring meaning to life? Will Daniel realize the love he had with Mark is worth more than the sweat spent in other men's beds?
And that book is available in paperback form and Kindle form through Amazon.com. And for those of you who are just joining us, Today we're speaking with Wayne Kay, who is a recovering person, and he is talking about sexual addiction primarily and how God has changed him and created lasting recovery for himself. And before we broke for the commercial, I asked Wayne if he'd be willing to talk about the consequences of his addictions, and so now I'd like to give you that opportunity.
Thanks, David. I have lost a couple of jobs over this addiction. I had worked for a company for 25 years, and because of an affair that I was having away from home, the general manager of the company at that time, I was fairly high up on the title list. I was a director of this company. He said to me he wanted me to resign because of what's going on. I said, well, it really wasn't any of his business. And so he actually went to human resources, and I was terminated. And so that was a job that I had actually, as I had previously stated, was the one I was flying around the country on their nickel and spending a lot of their dollars on my addiction. So it was a way to maybe reconnect and not travel. And so that was one of those connections. I got another job almost right away, and I continued to seek some dalliances, if you will, on the internet, and I got into, I was on an adult chat room where you had to sign a waiver that you're 18 years old, and you had to have a credit card to do the chat, and so I started chatting with this woman, and she was supposed to be an 18-year-old cheerleader from California, and she soon revealed to me that she was not 18. But I continued to chat with her rather than find somebody else. Long story short, when I went to a convention out in California, we met. And 2 days after we met, the police knocked on my door. I was arrested for statutory rape and a couple other things. And so now I'm 2,500 miles away from home, and I got a call home. I don't have any bail money. I don't have any lawyers that I know where I was in San Francisco. And in program, that's called disclosure. So sometimes disclosure statements are done slowly over time, as someone might find out something. You leave a piece of paper around, they look in your cell phone, and sometimes things are sudden. And when you're in jail looking for bail, that's a sudden moment, and then to pick up that phone and call. So that began a two-and-a-half-year odyssey, actually, of me. I did get bail after about 5.5 months of resisting extradition to California. After 2.5 years, I did plead no contest to statutory rape, and with that, my sentence was time served, and also I had to register as a sex offender. And the sex offender status was, fortunately, as a low-level one that's not discoverable in the state I'm in, so that the consequences could be worse. I did go through my IRA at the time, $300,000 to $400,000 when you start taking that stuff out with penalty, paying for a lawyer in California, a lawyer locally, travel back and forth to L.A. And San Francisco over 2 years. It was an experience that I don't want anyone to repeat it, but by the same token, it was my bottom. And in recovery, you'll hear people talk about their bottom and what happened to them. And I remember being in a holding cell with some people that were, I want to call them undesirables. I don't know a polite term for. I never associated with criminals. So when I'm in this holding cell, when they're all fairly small, I was having an anxiety attack. In retrospect, and I started praying, and all of a sudden, an angel appeared to me, David, and he was so big, he could barely stand up in the cell. His muscles were rippling. He was not a gentle angel. This guy was a male angel. This guy was a toned, ripped up, fitness guy that looked like he could defeat anybody. And he put his arms and wings around me and comforted me and said, it's going to be okay. And I never worried about the outcome of my case thereafter. I don't know if I'll ever see another one again, and you can call me crazy for thinking I saw one, all right, but I did see one, and it was quite an experience.
Well, talk about a spiritual experience. That's amazing, and I believe in such things, so I certainly am not going to call you crazy. What you've talked about has been consequences of your addiction, and I think you're a very brave man to talk about the situation that got you into the most trouble, and so I thank you for sharing that with us. Hopefully, it will help somebody else to recognize that there can be very serious consequences from this addiction. Jail and death are a couple of things, and there's no going back when you get to that latter one. So I would encourage anybody that's had some consequences that have been less painful to wake up and reach out for help, because there is help out there. And I would like to just take a moment to identify the different 12-step groups available for help with sexual addiction. The one that Wayne has already mentioned is SAA, which stands for Sex Addicts Anonymous. There's also SLAA, which is Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. There's SCA, which is Sexual Compulsives Anonymous, and SA, which is Sexaholics Anonymous. And depending on where you live, you may or you may not find one or more of these programs. You may find none. But in the example of SAA, you can go onto their website, and there are telemeetings. There are meetings on the web. So it is still possible to get into recovery, into a recovery program, whether or not there is a local meeting for you to attend. So don't waste any time. Get out there before the consequences get more serious, because this is a progressive disease. And I would just like to ask you if you consider sexual addiction to be a disease, Wayne.
I do, and I wanted to add one other group, David, that you didn't mention that's been instrumental in keeping my marriage together, and that is Recovering Couples Anonymous, RCA. Because if I didn't have the tools of the program, or my wife and I had not been in that, I probably would be divorced now based on what happened to me being arrested.
Hmm.
Okay, so and the Patrick Carnes, who, to my knowledge, coined the term sexual addiction, has said to me in a private conversation, he doesn't have empirical data on this yet, that if a partner is in recovery in some other program and you are a sex addict, that your chances of recovery are twice as great that you will succeed versus someone who doesn't have a partner who is supportive. So I think anytime you can double your chances of success, that's worth mentioning.
It sure is. Well, thank you for mentioning RCA. Can you talk about the difference between recovery from alcoholism and sexual addiction? Which was easier for you and why?
Well, the AA piece for me was ultimately easier. either you're going to drink or you're not going to drink. It's just pretty black and white with AA. With sex, it's not a question of not having sex. It's a question of having healthy sex and healthy relationships. And there are people that I have talked to that still struggle with that concept of what is healthy sexuality and what am I allowing myself to do. And when I have flashbacks or when I'm have other thoughts, you know, should I beat myself up? And so sexuality is a much tougher animal to address. And there are, your listeners should know that not every therapist believes that there is sex addiction or such a thing as sex addiction. So they may have to do a little searching in order to find the right therapist. I don't know if that's been your
really
experience.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
It has, and I think that's a really good point. If you want to find somebody that can really help you, find somebody that either has some background in sexual addiction or is willing to learn about it and who does not stigmatize it or cast a judgment that it's not a disease. Because if you have a therapist like that, it's time to make a change. Your chances of recovery are going to be much slimmer with that kind of therapist. Can you tell us what steps you've taken to manage your addiction?
The SAA has a concept called the three circles, and there's an outer circle, which are good things, like good relationships, pets, hobbies. There's an inner circle where things are definitely bad, compulsive masturbation, pornography, things that you yourself define as inner and outer circle. And in between those two circles, David, is a middle circle that may be things that lead you into the inner circle or lead you away from it. So I've had it described both ways, and so I find it easier to define the outer and inner circle than I do a middle circle, except that when I, for instance, may be doing an extended period on the computer, which is always sometimes a trigger for me. I need to sometimes take a break and make sure that I'm not feeling old patterns, or I don't want to go back into websites where they got me in trouble in the past, for instance. So the when I first got into recovery, there was a psychologist in West LA, Rob Weiss, who said, "We're literally going to rewire you so that your synapses are so used to doing, when you do X, they do Y, that we need to train them to not expect that end result again."
Well, thank you for that, Wayne. I wanted to just, I'm losing my train of thought, folks. Sorry about that. Let me ask you, Wayne, you talked about how you define God today as being a God of love. Where do you place God in your life today?
I place him, and I consider it a him, front and center. I am not a I don't go to church daily, but I do pray daily. I believe less in religiosity, but more spirituality these days. I'll phrase it that way. And so I don't think that for me the trappings of religion, to physically go into church is not necessary for me to connect with God. I don't need an intermediary like a priest or a minister, although I think they're there for a reason, so I'm not dismissing them. Certainly, whether it's a rabbi, priest, imam, or whoever, those people have studied their backgrounds, and so they're experts, and so you should rely on them if you have a need to do that. I didn't mean to be dismissive of that, David, if you know what I mean.
I do.
Okay.
I think it's important to point out that 12-step recovery programs are not religious programs. They are spiritual programs, and people have the flexibility of defining their higher power, which Wayne and I call God, but you do not have to have a belief in a traditional God. There are atheists in the program, and they can frame their higher power as being the power of the group. So it's not a limiting program. It's not exclusive. It's inclusive. And don't be afraid to get into 12-step recovery if you don't have a belief in God. That should not be a barrier. I remembered what I was going to ask you, Wayne. You were talking about, I lost it again. I can't believe it. Well, this happens. Maybe it will come to me. It seemed like it was an important point at the time. Can you explain what your powerlessness over addictive behavior has been about for you?
Well, yes, I think for many years I didn't really think I was powerless, and so I've actually had a therapist who fired me as a patient because I wanted to run my own recovery. Until you can get on your knees and say, you know, I really am tired of this. I don't want this anymore. I want it out of my life. At some point, we all get there in an act of desperation or in a manner of thinking that that's something that I want to change, and that change can appear in many ways. And then for me, it was being arrested. So that for me, that low, that bottom that I hit, I said, you know, enough of this already. I don't want to be in jail, and you know, God, if you'll help me, I'll do more of your work, or I'll work for the fellowship. And I have, in fact, worked for one of the 12-step fellowships on an international capacity for almost 5 years now.
Great, Wayne. Service is very important in terms of maintaining recovery. And the 12th step in recovery really has to do with giving it away, carrying the message, being of service to others. And it did occur to me what I was going to ask you. I could answer it myself, but I'm going to pose the question to you. What are the considerations for somebody to remain sexually sober in SAA? Is that predefined?
No, not at all. In fact, one of my mistakes in early recovery was I had a very small, strict definition of what sobriety was, and so I kept relapsing. I finally loosened up that definition a little bit to allow some other things in my middle circle that were in my inner circle, for instance. And so each person who goes to an SAA meeting along with their sponsors should, and I think the sponsor should have input, or they should be asking someone, how do you think about this? What do you think about it? It defines what their sobriety is, and that's not true, for instance, of some of the S programs. Some of them define are pretty rigid when it comes to sexual sobriety.
I think that's an important point and something that somebody is going to want to consider when they're shopping around for a program that's going to be of help to them, because, as Wayne said, some of the S programs are very rigid and very limiting. Without identifying the program, there's one that would not be helpful to gay people, perhaps, because the only acceptable version of sobriety is sex within a heterosexual marriage. So please shop around and find what is a good fit for you. And again, online meetings and telephone meetings are an option within certain S programs. Just Google sexual addiction recovery, and you will find information there. Can you tell me what the challenges have been for you in staying sexually sober, Wayne?
Well, I think for me it's been more defining what healthy sexuality is. I went through a bout of sexual anorexia, believing that abstinence or no sex was better than acting out, which probably it is. That may not be true for everyone, but for me, to get that sexual abstinence got me grounded in sobriety, and then I could explore what healthy sexuality means between myself and my wife. And there are things that I just don't. I don't go to pornography websites. I don't when I go to the barbershop, I don't pick up Playboy. There are things that are second nature now that were a challenge. When I first got on the program, was a victory for me to go to a newsstand and not pick up a Playboy. So it's progress, not perfection, and that's happened over 17 years. It certainly didn't happen overnight, David.
Right, right. And that's an important concept in recovery. It is about progress. And sometimes, especially within this program, slips are to be expected, and it's important not to beat yourself up over them, because it is different than putting down a substance, as Wayne was saying. So the key is to be gentle with yourself and not beat yourself up, because that can lead to shame, which can just perpetuate the cycle of addiction. What would you say to somebody that's suffering from addiction and trying to manage it on their own?
Well, let me lump this with something you just brought into my mind about talking about a substance addiction, and that is that dopamine is 50 times more addictive than heroin. And so when I talk to a psychologist or someone who may not believe that sex addiction is a true addiction, I make that analogy that in laboratory tests they've shown that dopamine is very addictive. And so we become, as sex addicts, addictive to that brain chemistry, that release of dopamine and adrenaline that comes from picking up that Playboy, looking at a picture, going on to a pornography site. So there are other ways that we have to rewire our brains to get back into that thought process, to do other things, to say, I'm not going to do that. And the healthy thing is to do X, Y, or Z. So and I may not have answered your question or not, David.
Well, in a sense you did. I just wondered if you had any constructive advice or suggestions to offer to somebody that's out there and white-knuckling it without any help.
Yeah, yes, I do. What I recommend is that if you go to a meeting, whatever meeting you choose that may be convenient for you to get to, go six times and decide if it's for you. Just don't go once, because that's not doing yourself any favors. You need to go. If they have some literature, maybe they can give you some, or maybe you need to buy a book, do some reading. I tend to learn by reading. I tend to be experiential. I like to learn by listening to other people in meetings. So the more meetings you go to, the better chance you're going to have. You're going to hear something that clicks with you. You may not hear it that first time. And as you said, David, shop around. There are more than one program that you can go to, usually, to get some recovery. White knuckling is not going to work.
No. In the end, it's a real setup.
Yeah.
The other thing that I was going to say is that I think it's very important that people not only shop around, but just try to use the power of affirmation. I found that affirmation is so important in my own recovery, and that goes back to this low self-esteem stuff that I've had as an issue in my past, and I've had to try to create statements of strength and to write them down, say them out loud as if I believe them, whether or not that is true, because I've had to re-engineer that brain chemistry. I've had to create belief that I am a loving person, that I am sexually sober today, that I have the power within me, not to say that I can do it on my own. I'm not saying that. I believe the power of God resides within each and every one of us and that God is present in everything and everywhere. So when I say that I have the power within me, I'm talking about the power of God. So I would encourage people to consider affirmations. Getting back to the God piece, what would you say to people who have no faith or who have lost their faith?
Well, there is, the first thing I would tell them is that there is a chapter written in 1933 maybe, in the AA Big Book called A Chapter for the Agnostics. And I would probably start by reading that. Here's something that is 80 years old, and it's still relevant. It talks about specifically addressing that problem, and it is a problem. If you're going to be in recovery and you want to be successful, I mean, I've been in rooms where people said, you know, I'm just not a believer. I said, fine, then hold the group as your higher power. I don't care if you hold that doorknob as your higher power. Just create one, because it's going to help you. And that's where I would start, David.
Thank you. And just briefly, for people that have no idea what 12-step recovery is about, when you come to your first meeting, you're going to hear a lot of talk about the first three steps. Would you be able to summarize those in a nutshell and tell us why those are so important?
Sure. Step one is, you know, we came to believe that we couldn't, we were powerless over our addiction. And so powerlessness talks about the fact that we are unable to make those choices. And so it's an important thing to admit that you're powerless. And I'm having a brain cramp here, David, on two and three.
That's all right. I'll just briefly summarize them, because we do need to close the interview. But the second step is came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And what that speaks of is that the life that we were living as addicts was insane behavior, leading to insane actions, insane thinking, and that through developing a relationship with a higher power, we can retrain ourselves and use something as simple as our conscience as our guide, and then finally turning it over to that higher power and allowing that higher power to lead the way. And so we've come to a close, Wayne, and I would just like to thank you very much for stepping in today. We were supposed to have Brendan Fay today, and Brendan will be rescheduled at a later date. So thank you, Wayne.
Thank you, David, for the invite, and I wish you well.
Thank you so much. Once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our own individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
Yeah. You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks to find common ground and take it to the next level here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.